Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Margaret Kelly, who goes by Peggy of Johnston, happy birthday to you. And Joyce Lentz of Des Moines, we wish you the happiest of birthdays today. If you share a birthday with Peggy and Joyce and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to today's USA Today. The editors of USA Today have compiled a list of 5 things they think we need to know this Monday, June 29th, 2020. Many Americans say it would be inappropriate for either party to dispute election. A majority of Americans say they would find it inappropriate if the November election's outcome was disputed in a variety of ways, a new study released Monday finds. About 2/3 of Americans, 67%, believe it would be inappropriate if President Donald Trump loses but refuses to leave office because he claims he has credible evidence of illegal voting, according to a report from the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group. Over the past several weeks, Trump has claimed, without evidence, that the election is rigged, specifically taking aim at the many states looking to expand mail-in voting due to the coronavirus pandemic. Many experts have disputed his claim. Second, Texas prepares for showdown over sex ed in schools. For the first time in 2 decades, the Texas State Board of Education is slated to make changes to its sex education curriculum, triggering a likely showdown between conservative and liberal state activists. The last revisions to the health education standards were in 1997, and much of the debate is expected to revolve around issues of contraception, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Curriculum work groups made up of school officials, teachers, and health experts began drafting revisions to the standards last September. The State Board will hold its first public hearing on the matter Monday, with a final vote on the changes in November. Third, first hearing on clearing of peaceful protesters before Trump's church photo op. Members of Congress will hold a hearing Monday on the forcible clearing of peaceful protesters before President Donald Trump's controversial walk to St. John's Church for a photo opportunity. On June 1st, protesters were removed from a nearby park using chemical irritants, rubber bullets, shields, and horses before Trump walked across the street from the White House to pose with a Bible in front of the historic church, along with members of his administration. The forcible clearing of peaceful protesters drew wide condemnation. Kishon McDonald, a protester who was injured that day by law enforcement, is expected to testify along with Amelia Brace, an Australian reporter who was repeatedly punched by law enforcement officers, and the Right Reverend Marianne Budd, the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, which includes St. John's Church. The Democrat-led committee said the hearing will focus on determining what happened, whether excessive force was used, and what policy options are available. Fourth, new report finds gap between black and white homeownership. Among black families, 44% own their own home as of the first quarter of this year, compared to 73.7% of white families, according to Monday's new U.S. Census report. And that disparity is even greater depending on the city, according to an analysis of census data by the national real estate brokerage Redfin. Quote, the mechanism of wealth funnels across all of those different areas, says Taylor Marr, Redfin's lead economist. Black families experienced a slight uptick in home ownership in the past year, inching up from 41.1% during the first quarter of 2019. But that progress is threatened by the coronavirus pandemic, which is disproportionately affecting both the physical and financial health of Black Americans. And number five, flight testing for Boeing's grounded 737 MAX expected to begin. Flight certification testing for Boeing's 737 MAX, which has been grounded since March 2019 because of two deadly crashes, could begin as early as Monday, according to a Federal Aviation Administration email sent Sunday to congressional oversight committees. The company needs clearance from the FAA before the planes can fly again, and the test flights with FAA test pilots are a key step. They would take several days and would evaluate Boeing's proposed changes to the automated flight control system on the MAX. The flight control system, triggered by faulty readings from sensors, pushed the planes into nosedives that led to crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia, killing 346 people. In coronavirus updates, as global deaths pass 500,000, confirmed cases exceed 10 million. More than 500,000 people have died from the coronavirus, and global cases have now surpassed 10 million, according to the Johns Hopkins University data dashboard. The milestones Sunday came as the United States continues to break single-day records of new cases. One quarter of those confirmed cases have come in the U.S. That pattern also applies to global deaths resulting from the virus. Of the nearly 500,000 worldwide deaths, the U.S. accounts for more than 125,000. Brazil is the next closest country, with more than 1.3 million confirmed cases. As virus keeps spreading, bars to close in L.A. and six other California counties. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced Sunday that he is ordering bars in certain counties to close while recommending closures in others. The counties ordered to close bars are Los Angeles, Fresno, Imperial, Kern, Kings, San Joaquin, and Tulare. Newsom also said that he is recommending bars close in Contra Costa, Riverside, Sacramento, San Bernardino, Santa Barbara, Santa Clara, Stanislaus, and Ventura counties. This came as cases in California are once again surging. The state's confirmed cases surpassed 206,000 on Friday, including an increase of 5,972. According to the Johns Hopkins University data dashboard, Los Angeles County is the one with the most confirmed coronavirus cases in the United States, with more than 95,000 as of Sunday afternoon. Quote, COVID-19 is still circulating in California and in some parts of the state growing stronger, Newsom said in a statement. Quote, that's why it is critical we take this step to limit the spread of the virus in the counties that are seeing the biggest increases, end quote. Pennsylvania City to close bars and limit alcohol in restaurants. Allegheny County officials announced Sunday that it will close bars and restrict restaurants from selling alcohol on site. This decision comes after the county reported 96 new positive coronavirus cases Sunday, the highest daily number recorded, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported. Bars and out-of-state travel are two hot spots in the country, Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald said at a news conference Sunday. Restaurants will remain open, but they cannot sell alcohol for on-site consumption, only takeout. New York had lowest single-day death toll since March 15th. New York went from having as many as 800 coronavirus deaths a day to a new low on Saturday, just 5 fatalities. Governor Andrew Cuomo said the 5 deaths marked the fewest daily deaths from COVID-19 since March 15th. A roughly 3-month turnaround for a state that had been the epicenter of the nation's death toll from the coronavirus. The state's 5 deaths were coupled with 869 hospitalizations on Saturday, and of the 61,906 tests conducted in New York State on Saturday, 616, or 0.99%, were positive. The news came one day after Cuomo signed an executive order Saturday that strips paid sick leave protection for New York employees who voluntarily travel to high-risk states after June 25th. New York still leads the nation with 24,835 deaths from the virus, and nearly 392,000 people in the state have tested positive. Pittsburgh churches welcome back parishioners after attendee tests negative. The Pittsburgh Catholic Diocese said masses could resume at several churches after a parishioner tested negative for the coronavirus, CBS local affiliate KDKA2 reported. The parishioner tested negative after they may have been exposed through a relative. In-person masses resumed today, and weekday masses will begin again on Monday, reported at the news station. Father Kevin Poking, pastor of the churches at Oakmont, Plum, and Verona, said that the church has and will continue to follow all CDC and diocesan guidelines and state regulations. Quote, "We had been praying for a negative test result and were so happy to receive the news," Poking said. Previous guidelines from the diocese put church capacity for Mass at 25%. Immigrants, advocates, members of Congress decry chemical use at ICE facility in Adelanto. Detained immigrants in Southern California are alleging that staff at the Adelanto ICE Processing Center in the Mojave Desert are disinfecting the facility amid the pandemic by spraying hazardous chemicals in poorly ventilated areas, causing people to develop bloody noses, burning eyes, and coughing fits, which could further spread the coronavirus. Immigrant advocates, attorneys, and members of Congress are now decrying the practice and calling for answers. Chris Arisol, a Seychelles native who has been detained at Adelanto for about 22 months, said guards, quote, "constantly," end quote, spray a product called HDQ Neutral on door handles, railings, and tables, even while people are eating and drinking nearby. HDQ Neutral, quote, "destroys antibiotic-resistant bacteria, including MRSA and tough viruses," according to manufacturer Spartan Chemical. Safety data posted on the company's website warns the product is harmful if swallowed or inhaled and causes severe skin burns and eye damage. It says people should not eat or drink when using the product and should not breathe the mist vapors or spray. It should be used, quote, "only outdoors or in a well-ventilated area," end quote. According to a report, only two states reporting decreases of new coronavirus cases. Just two states, Connecticut and Rhode Island, reported a decline of new coronavirus cases this week compared to the previous week, CNN reported Sunday. New cases rose in a staggering 36 states, the report said. Florida and Texas are among the worst affected. Florida reported a record 9,585 new cases on Saturday, shattering its mark for most in a day since the pandemic started. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced that he would order a pause to the state's reopening plan. In front page news on USA Today, Kyle Bagenstos, Dinah Pulver, and Kevin Crowe report flood risks across USA worse than many think. A new nationwide flood modeling tool released Monday paints a picture of the U.S. as a country woefully underprepared for damaging floods now and in the future. The federal government's best efforts to predict where flooding will strike have underestimated the risk to nearly 6 million homes and commercial properties, primarily in the nation's interior, leaving them unprepared for potential devastation, the analysis shows. Meanwhile, the model prepares coastal states and cities for risks to come as their communities head toward a future of more intense storms and rising seas. Experts say the analysis is the latest evidence of a decades-long bungling of flood planning and policy at multiple levels of government across the country. And it presents difficult new questions about who will pay billions of dollars to save communities from going underwater: homeowners, towns, and cities, or the U.S. taxpayer. Quote, "Who is going to pay and how we are going to pay is the ultimate question," said A.R. Siders, a professor at the University of Delaware's Disaster Research Center. The analysis was conducted by the First Street Foundation, a nonprofit organization that paired dozens of scientists and engineers with researchers from academic institutions, including the University of California, Berkeley, George Mason University, and Rutgers University. The team combined several existing models of sea level rise, riverine flooding, and simulations of extreme weather events into a single nationwide flood assessment model that examined risk in all states except Alaska and Hawaii. While insurance and investment companies such as BlackRock have long used their own private models to make decisions, First Street will allow users of its flood factor site to view flood risks to individual properties and created a flood lab that allows academic researchers to further access data for research. "The group's modeling is, quote, exactly what we need to be doing," end quote, said Carrie Emanuel, a professor of atmospheric science at MIT, who serves on First Street's advisory board. Quote, "Until recently, we didn't have people putting all these little pieces together. We had really good people working on that little piece of the problem and good people working on another little corner." End quote. First Street's newly combined model found that about 14.6 million homes and other structures across the country face a 1% annual risk of flooding, representing about 1 out of every 10 such real estate parcels nationwide. But First Street calculated that current maps developed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency list just 8.7 million properties in the floodplain, a 40% undercount compared with what First Street found. And the situation is getting worse. In addition to a present-day analysis, First Street's modeling incorporated 2050 projections from the International Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations' primary scientific body on the issue. The conclusion? Another 1.6 million properties will be at 1.1% annual risk of flooding by 2050. The 1% threshold is the gold standard used by the federal government to assess which homeowners are required to buy flood insurance. But experts say it's also misleading, as it actually equates a 1-in-4 chance of flooding over the course of a 30-year mortgage. Local and county planners also use the threshold to determine which areas are safe to develop. Many flood experts said the discrepancy between the two models wasn't surprising, given the limitations baked into FEMA's calculations. The federal agency is stretched thin, struggling to keep its flood maps up to date, particularly for inland areas perceived to be less vulnerable than the coasts, experts said. The agency also looks only at historical data to assess where flooding could strike next, leaving out current and future models. Eric Tate, a professor at the University of Iowa, who early in his career built flood modeling tools as a FEMA contractor, agreed the agency's maps can be outdated, miss lower priority areas, and at times become subject to political influence through a revision process. Quote, "As a result of all these, there's a lack of uniformity nationwide," said Tate, who plans to use First Street's data in his research. Quote, "You have a map here that's based on this set of data and this way of analysis, and then you have another map somewhere else, and it's different," end quote. Maps versus models. FEMA's maps and First Street's model depict different kinds of risk in severe, different, and serve different purposes, said FEMA Press Secretary Lizzie Litzo. The agency sees First Street's flood factor as a tool to inform a property owner's decision to buy flood insurance or take steps to reduce individual flood risk, Litzo said. FEMA's maps remain the backbone of effective floodplain management, said David Marsad, the agency's Deputy Associate Administrator for Insurance and Mitigation. Local adoption of minimum standards based on the maps helped avoid $100 billion in losses over the past 40 years, he said. FEMA's regulatory maps depict the 1% chance annual event, but flood risks exist outside that floodplain, Litzo said. By the agency's own accounting, 20% of flood claims come from properties outside high-risk flood zones. Although people try to compare flood maps to actual events, Litzo said, it's, quote, not an apples-to-apples comparison, end quote. Still, First Street's analysis, which used a uniform modeling system across the lower 48 states, helps expose the potential scale of missed risk. Many of the largest discrepancies are driven by states and cities not typically considered at high risk for flooding. In California, nearly 600,000 properties are at 1% annual risk for flooding under First Street's model, but not under FEMA's. That's the largest gap of any state. Chicago leads among all cities. First Street calculates that nearly 76,000 additional properties there should be in the floodplain. The implications of First Street's findings stretch far beyond huge urban centers. Under its calculations, no state is more at risk than West Virginia, where mountainous terrain has historically forced communities to crowd near rivers and creeks in deep valleys. In that state, nearly 1 out of every 4 properties reached the 1% risk threshold under First Street's model, a higher proportion than in Florida and Louisiana, and a significant jump from 1 in 10 properties under FEMA. In June 2016, the risk became reality in West Virginia when heavy rains led to flash flooding that killed 23 people in several counties. Even more dramatic increases occur along the Gulf Coast in communities in Florida and Texas. In Pine Manor, a neighborhood several miles south of Fort Myers, Florida, only 0.3% of properties now reside in FEMA's 100-year floodplain. That jumps to 99.6% under First Street's analysis. Like a Carfax for homes. In addition to releasing a report with its findings, First Street has created a so-called flood factor tool the company promotes as a way for homeowners and buyers to evaluate a property's risk for flooding. The tool also allows users to review whether the property flooded in the past and receive wider statistics for their zip code, county, and state. Some say the application has perhaps the greatest implications for any use of First Street's model. While the tool likely won't immediately transform the real estate market, experts predict it will grow as Americans become more familiar with the tool and others like it. Quote, "This sounds like a Carfax for homes," said Larry Bartlett, the property appraiser for Valuesia County, Florida, home of Daytona Beach. But several experts urged caution, noting all models have limitations. William Sweet, an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said the new model may be, quote, "a big step forward in understanding risk." But no model is perfect, he said, and there are still gaps in the understanding of how likely certain weather events are to occur. Quote, "We've only been well positioned to monitor these things in the last 50 to 75 years," Sweet said. Quote, "How do we make assumptions and assessments about today's risk when we can't really model and monitor all the components that go into calculating that risk?" While determining a community's flood risk is challenging, experts say equally as daunting is figuring out what to do next. Decisions about building in flood zones are almost entirely made by local and county governments. Each face their own unique challenges, and many find it difficult to give up the short-term benefits of waterfront development because of the chance of a flood decades down the road. Quote, "The incentives are stacked against," end quote, "local leadership to respond proactively," Sider said. But Tate said historically disadvantaged communities, not wealthy ones, face the greatest challenges from flooding. His recent research found that the populations exposed to the highest levels of flood risk are disproportionately African American, Native American, and residents of mobile homes. Quote, "Many of these counties and communities that have lower capacity are also places where the economics aren't as strong, or there's a higher percentage of racial minorities," Tate said. "The problem with putting flood risk on the back burner is that someone has to pay for it," experts say. "The economic harm driven by devalued real estate and insurance premiums is real, but so too are the costs of picking up the pieces after a flood hits." Quote, "There's always been this kind of tension between wanting to protect home values, but also wanting to be clear about risks and manage those risks effectively," Kowski said. "Those price adjustments reflect a real underlying risk," end quote. And currently, U.S. taxpayers subsidize that risk, Kowski said. The federal government's National Flood Insurance Program is the primary provider of flood insurance policies, which is required by law for any property with a federally backed mortgage within the 100-year floodplain. Kowski said the program has been underwater ever since Hurricane Katrina wiped out its coffers in 2005, followed by additional hits from hurricanes like Sandy and Harvey in 2017, Congress voted and President Donald Trump signed off on $16 billion in debt forgiveness for the program. The money theoretically should have been paid back to the federal government for use elsewhere. FEMA has set aggressive targets for increasing insurance coverage and closing the insurance gap, Litzgau said, and is making some progress in working the state, local, and industry partners to help at-risk communities and promote flood insurance. The agency, quote, "is constantly working to improve the production of the flood insurance rate maps within the context of changing conditions," Marstadt said. Quote, "We're exploring ways to leverage new technologies and provide flood information more efficiently, accurately, and consistently across the nation," end quote. Experts say there are no easy fixes as each solution creates its own problem. Raising premiums can disproportionately hurt disadvantaged communities and drive people away from insurance. Requiring more disclosure about risks and past flooding can penalize those who are honest and reward those who aren't. Quote, "A fundamental piece of this is trying to decide from a public values perspective how much catastrophic risk we want individual homeowners to bear and how much we think should be socialized," Kowski said. A flooded future? Ticking away in the background is the reality that the situation is only getting worse. Baking in future climate change projections, First Street's model anticipates rapid growth in the number of at-risk properties in coastal cities, particularly along the Gulf Coast. This year, First Street's model shows about 48,000 properties in New Orleans are within the 100-year flood zone, or a little less than one-third of the city. By 2050, nearly 100,000 more will be added to the list, or 98% of the city. FEMA does have a hazardous mitigation grant program that buys out at-risk homes and relocates residents to higher ground. Siders said the program has purchased about 45,000 homes since first established in 1989. Although the number may seem large, it only amounts to about 30 homes per state per year. Meanwhile, new development within floodplains continues in many communities across the country. Quote, we can't figure out how we're going to pay for homes that are already at risk, and now we're adding more, and we're adding more by the thousands, Siders said. Quote, that means we're putting thousands of more families at risk with no plan for how we're going to pay to help them get out in the future, end quote. In other front page news, Joel Shannon of USA Today reports on a recent poll, most Americans want significant police reform. Most Americans believe that change must be made to law enforcement across the nation and that reforms are needed to reduce police brutality against Black Americans, a poll released Monday found. Among the ideas embraced by many of those polled June 18th through 22nd by Ipsos on behalf of Public Agenda and USA Today, force officers to reapply for their jobs to help weed out bad cops, limit the scope of policing to focus on serious and violent crimes, cut off police departments' ability to buy military gear. Those reforms are in addition to widespread and bipartisan support for more training on de-escalation tactics and racial biases, as well as numerous reforms aimed at increasing transparency. The poll surveyed 1,113 U.S. adults as part of the Hidden Common Ground initiative, which focuses on agreement and disagreement on solutions to tough public problems. The online poll has a credibility interval akin to a margin of error of plus or minus 3.3 percentage points for all respondents. The data comes after weeks of nationwide protests calling for racial equality and an end to police brutality. In respondent Lalaj Carruthers, 83 years, she has never seen such far-reaching attention on the issues. An African-American woman living in Shelby, North Carolina, she can remember the end of segregation, her daughter's school integrating, and a federal mandate that her nursing unit do the same. But today, Americans' reckoning with racial inequality is extending to even historical symbols of slavery and racism, especially Confederate statues. It's unlike anything Carruthers has seen. Cases of police brutality that have attracted national attention and protesting don't happen in isolation. Quote, it's a problem with the whole system, she said. Someone had to hire the officers, after all, end quote. Yes, there is a problem. About 3 in 4 people surveyed say racial bias against Black Americans is a serious problem in the United States. Slightly fewer say it's a problem in their community. Asked whether racism is a problem with individuals or society, respondents were more likely to say both. More than half said major changes or a total redesign were needed. Few believe things should stay the way they are. Only 7% want to leave policing and law enforcement the way it is. Quote, some officers will profile Black people. I know I can get away with more things as a white person than a Black person could, Yismo Rosenberg of Houston told USA Today. He believes poor training among officers is probably to blame. The poll found several reforms that focused around training and diversity in policing had support from 3/4 or more of respondents. Requiring all officers to undergo training on de-escalation tactics to avoid the use of force, requiring all officers to undergo training on how to be less racially biased, and recruiting more Black Americans to become police officers. Even more popular, transparency reforms. 9 in 10 respondents supported having officers wear body cameras. 8 in 10 supported requiring police departments to publicly report all incidents involving the use of force within 72 hours. And nearly as many supported creating a national public database of officers who have used excessive force and prohibiting other jurisdictions from rehiring them. More extreme forms of police reform have varying levels of support, often with political divides. But the poll found 2 major reforms were supported by more than half of poll takers. focusing policing on serious or violent crimes and requiring all police officers to reapply for their jobs, hiring back and retraining only the most qualified. Let's turn now to the opinion section of today's Des Moines Register. We'll begin with letters to the editor, which include one written by John Mallett of Des Moines, titled, News Media Shouldn't Be Involved in Cheerleading. The number of news articles, letters, and opinions supporting the protests, Black Lives Matter, and the Democratic Party while criticizing President Donald Trump and Governor Kim Reynolds with a shortage of factual and an abundance of false information far outnumber articles and letters containing specific statements with clear and corroborating evidence to the contrary. Opinions and advocacy are one thing, but silencing those presenting facts that might shed light on those opinions is not what news organizations purporting to seek and report the truth should be doing. The First Amendment is not merely a slogan or excuse for the news media to write, say, or do anything free from criticism or possible legal constraints. It is a promise to the American people that in return for freedom from censorship and government interference, the news media, in order to ensure a well-informed citizenry essential to democracy, will be guardians of the truth and will seek, discover, and report it in an objective, unbiased manner. It is obvious to many that over the past 20 years, the news media have not kept their end of the bargain and instead have become not truth seekers, but advocates for the progressive ideology and actions of the Democratic Party and its anarchist allies, and now constitute the biggest threat to our constitutional republic. Signed, John Mallett of Des Moines. Max Higgison of Grinnell writes, Biden's one-letter advantage. I was just thinking of what a difference one letter can make in our upcoming national election. I support Biden's run, and I fear Trump's ruin of our nation. Signed, Max Higgison of Grinnell. Mike Schlesinger of Marshalltown writes, school guidance abominable. I hope Iowans are paying attention to the recently released Iowa Department of Education guidelines for reopening schools this fall. I am shocked that the state is not only not requiring face masks to be worn by students and staff, it is even recommending schools not require it. It is unfathomable to me that the state has not followed all the data globally that shows using face masks will help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. I am hopeful our Iowa school systems use better judgment than the Department of Education. Signed, Mike Schlesinger of Marshalltown. Today's opinion section of the Des Moines Register also includes two Your Turn columns with opposing views. One is written by Bob Moore, who is an architect and educator in Rhode Island. It's titled, The Message Sent by Iowa State's Cat Hall. Why do we build monuments? Why do we create memorials? Why do we name things after people? We do so not to revere the past, but to ensure that the places we occupy carry our story into the future. Our identity as a society is built upon and reinforced by the symbols and figures we revere in the public sphere, as they represent not the values of the past, but those values that we aspire to, those that we want to pass to future generations. Martin Luther King Jr.'s name adorns countless streets, parks, and places, not because we have reached the mountaintop, but because we too want to get there one day. I saw encouraging signs from my alma mater this month. Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein acted swiftly to remove a plaque honoring a clearly racist figure. She took the occasion to announce a broader initiative to establish a process for reconsidering other historical campus naming decisions. This raised some strong memories of my time at ISU. My work focused on how our identity as a society, our collective image, is manifest in what we build. Our cities and towns are littered with monuments to the failed and racist Confederacy. Most were mounted not in the Civil War era, but during Jim Crow, and they extend much further than the limits of the former Confederate states. To an entire population of Americans, Confederate monuments and statues memorialize and valorize a society that does not value them. No reasonable person who believes in a just and equitable society can defend those monuments. They belong in museums and archives, not in our public realm. As we see more racist monuments fall, I, like many, hope that we are seeing a tipping point in the perspective held by white Americans. Clearly, cracks are forming, and there are encouraging signs of a willingness to fight for positive change, be it what we expect from our public servants and institutions, or what kind of visual symbols we allow and promote in our public realm. So-called Old Botany Hall was renovated and dedicated as so-called Carrie Chapman Cat Hall when I was a freshman at Iowa State. The building is lovely. Queen Anne Revival details, a grand staircase, and wide, spacious balconies adorn the building that sits prominently and majestically on the edge of the campus quad. The renaming occasion should have been a true cause for celebration since Iowa State was naming the building after a female graduate, a famous figure in the women's suffrage movement. Unfortunately, in the rather opaque process of naming the building, the university ignored a glaring strain of racism with which all scholars of the 19th Amendment would have been familiar. When people objected to the name on the grounds that Cat's deeds as a suffragist were tainted by her racist strategy and ideas, the university did not take seriously the scholarship of those who researched and exposed Cat's own racism. The response, essentially, was that Cat's good deeds outweighed the bad. Cat's quote is burned into my memory. Quote, "White supremacy will be strengthened, not weakened, by women's suffrage," she wrote. It is disturbing. It is haunting. Despite a multi-year effort by the September 29th movement challenging the name and the naming process, the building still bears Cat's name today. When I see the building, I can't help but cringe. Its beautiful details transform to represent not the aspirations of a university or a society that embraces equality, but rather the opposite. It symbolizes exclusion. For people of color, the story of Cat Hall is all too familiar, and the pain is personal and visceral in a way that it cannot be for me as a white person. Cat Hall can be understood in its essential terms. It does not matter how much good one does if she was still a racist. The bad will forever taint the good. Is this whom we should honor? Place yourself in the shoes of a young prospective student of color and ask, if the university would praise someone who said such a thing, what do they think of me? Am I welcome here? Am I valued? This is the power of a name. It can turn a gorgeous building into the sound of a door slamming shut in one's face. Names are symbols, and symbols have meaning. Change the name of Cat Hall. Again, this opinion was written by Mob Moore, guest columnist. On the same page, opposite Mr. Moore's column, is one written by Tim Lane, a Waterloo native and graduate of the University of Northern Iowa and a retired public health professional. Carrie Chapman Cat was his aunt. His column is titled, "Cat Denounced Racism Throughout Her Career." I wish to be as clear as possible. In her efforts to provide African-American women the right to vote, Carrie Chapman Catt stood fast against the prejudice of the time and led the effort to pass the 19th Amendment in Tennessee. She knew that such a victory would be just one large battle and that there would be others to fight. That is why she created the League of Women Voters prior to the passage. Yes, in 1995, students stated and the press printed that she gave speeches in two southern states in support of white supremacy in 1920. More recently, the premise was enhanced to, quote, "speeches across the country," end quote. This is false. By 1920, Cat, who was my aunt, had been enfranchising African Americans for 27 years. The first recorded one I could locate was Elizabeth Ensley. As a result of the 1893 Colorado win for suffrage, one of Cat's most stunning and significant victories, Ms. Ensley won the right to vote. Ensley and her colleagues in the Colored Women's Republican Club and the Women's League of Denver put that vote to immediate use. They were successful in electing an African American, Joseph Henry Stewart, to the Colorado Assembly, along with three women. That 1894 election led to some groundbreaking civil rights legislation. That one victory in 1893 thus tipped dominoes for women, African Americans, and civil rights legislation in Colorado and other states. I am not saying the term white supremacy did not come up. Southerners claimed the passage of the amendment would end it. Cat responded that such a claim was not germane, and what they were really opposed to was gender equality. She then shared the numbers to destroy their argument. Anyone who reads the thousands of words in the chapter will tell you it ends with, quote, "the answer to one is the answer to all. Government by, quote, the people, end quote, is expedient or it is not. If it is expedient, then obviously all the people must be included," end quote. But her actions did not end there. This ISU alumna, who has been branded as a racist, spoke out against the Asian slave trade in 1900. she worked to give women the vote in the Philippines, China, Africa, and India, invited Gandhi to come visit her in her hotel suite in Johannesburg. Parenthetical comment, the hotel banned the visit, and she eventually visited him in his office. Was the only suffragist I am aware of who defended black occupation troops when slandered by Americans after World War I. Wrote editorials in The Crisis, an NAACP monthly publication, and was attacked in papers across Tennessee for her view that, quote, all Americans, men or women, white or black, shall share equally in the privilege of democracy, end quote. After the 19th Amendment was passed, she observed that she had to deal with, quote, negrophobia and other caveman prejudices, end quote. I would hope that any fair individual that cared deeply about justice and studied all of her actions and more of her words in the end would suggest that more be done to honor Carrie Chapman Catt. Again, this column was written by Tim Lane, a native of Waterloo and the nephew of Carrie Chapman Catt. Let's turn now to the opinion section of today's USA Today. We'll begin with a column written by John Tester and Chuck Grassley, titled, Threat of Meat Shortages is Growing. Senate Needs to Act Now. As two farmers from rural America who moonlight as U.S. senators, we know that many folks who live in urban centers may be unfamiliar with how meat goes from farms and ranches in Montana and Iowa to grocery stores in New York or Los Angeles. But it requires only a brief look under the hood of the beef supply chain to diagnose the grave crisis currently facing American farmers and ranchers, and the growing threat of shortages for every American family who buys meat at the grocery store. Beef begins its journey through the supply chain at one of our nation's cow-calf operators who raise cattle for the first 9 months of the animal's life before transferring them to a feeder for fattening. When a cow is ready to harvest, they are taken to the processing facility or meatpacking plant where they are slaughtered and packaged before the beef is shipped to grocery stores or exported. But in recent decades, the packing industry has become dangerously consolidated. Currently, only four large cup corporations control 80% of America's meat processing capacity, running massive processing plants and industrial feedlots. These corporate giants use their market share to drive down cash, or so-called spot, prices for cattle, and then use those depressed prices to set formulas to buy cows from independent farmers, ranchers, and feeders for dirt cheap, all while raising meat prices at the grocery store. And this problem started long before the pandemic, which has exposed the dangers of this consolidated industry by infecting thousands of plant employees, shutting down a quarter of our nation's meat processing capacity, making it more difficult for families to find meat at the grocery store, and jeopardizing our nation's food supply chain. The consequences are real. In the past 20 years, American families have seen meat prices more than double, while prices ranchers are getting for their cattle have risen less than half that. You don't need to be an economist to know that when you have only a few corporations determining prices and the price at the farm gate is going down, but the price of packaged beef is going up, you're not dealing with a capitalistic system. Now the pandemic has brought the industry to a crisis point. If the federal government doesn't act fast to help stabilize the market, America's small and independent cattle producers will go extinct. That means more industry consolidation, higher prices at the grocery store, economic destruction in rural America, and a vertical food supply chain even more easily crippled by a single accident or disaster. That's why we've introduced legislation to mandate the large packers purchase 50% of their cattle with so-called spot pricing, which will make it harder for corporations to manipulate and depress cattle prices and give cattle producers more opportunity to receive fair returns for their product. This won't solve the problem entirely, but it will help to provide badly needed relief to folks who are being squeezed by imbalanced markets and corporate greed. These cow-calf operators and small and medium-sized feeders are the backbone of our nation's food supply and the lifeblood of our economies in rural America. As farmers ourselves, we know producers don't want more regulation, and they certainly don't want a bailout. All they want is the market to work, and everything from the cost of meat at the supermarkets in Manhattan and Brooklyn, New York, to the livelihoods of farmers and ranchers in Manhattan, Montana, and Brooklyn, Iowa, depend on the Senate taking swift action to make sure it does. This column was written by Senator John Tester, who is a Democrat from Montana, and Senator Chuck Grassley, who is a Republican from Iowa. Today's opinion page also includes a column written by Scott Duke Harris, a former reporter for the Los Angeles Times and the San Jose Mercury News, who lives in Hong Kong. His column is titled, "Not Wearing Masks is Suicidal. Hong Kong Proves They Prevent Virus Spread." To mask or not to mask, that's still the question? Seriously? It shouldn't be, not when a lethal virus might be a sneeze, a cough, or simply a breath away. Not when the pandemic has killed nearly 500,000 people worldwide, including more than 125,000 in the United States, and several states are spiking. People here in Hong Kong understand this and wonder, why after so much misery are millions of Americans so clueless? This is a perspective from a masked metropolis, a semi-autonomous region of China, where people started wearing facial coverings back in January, not long after news spread of a mysterious outbreak in Wuhan, only about 570 miles away. With memories of severe acute respiratory syndrome and other deadly viruses, Hong Kongers didn't wait for a government directive to start masking up. Masks work. Masks have helped Hong Kong suppress this plague. Hong Kong is essentially Asia's version of New York City, a global hub that is similar in population, density, and reliance on mass transit. Yet while New York has buried tens of thousands of its residents, Hong Kong has recorded only 7 COVID-19 deaths out of about 1,200 total cases. Masks are a key reason why. And yet, America doesn't get it. The inane, disheartening debate is heard in practically every vicinity of every state. Millions of Americans prudently mask up, and millions pigheadedly, selfishly refuse. As former basketball pro Aubrey Huff put it, he'd, quote, rather die of coronavirus than wear a mask and live in fear, end quote. Which raises the question of whether such people would sacrifice mom and dad in their valiant struggle against public health. Masks are not the only reason for Hong Kong's success. Strong border controls, vigilant contact tracing, and targeted quarantine are vitally important. But masks are the one tool that is easily applied elsewhere. Facial coverings helped limit both the contagion and economic damage in Hong Kong. Residents here have never received blanket stay-at-home orders. Most shops and restaurants have remained open. In May, children returned to classrooms for the first time since January, providing that they wear masks, as do their teachers. 50 percentage points. Early this year, even before there was a run on toilet paper and disinfectant, surgical masks were hard to come by. One morning, I arrived at a local pharmacy 2 hours before its scheduled opening and found 24 people already in line. When the doors opened, the length of the queue had tripled, but the store had only 20 boxes of masks, one per customer. Oh well. Asian was on high alert while the rest of the world seemed as diffident as President Donald Trump. In late January, when the mask shortage was front-page news in Hong Kong, my wife bought top-shelf N95 masks while traveling through Singapore. She found them at a 7-Eleven. With rubber band straps and a tight fit, the N95 proved uncomfortable when I nervously shopped for groceries. Later, like the locals, I opted for the simpler surgical masks. More recently, the Hong Kong government has sent washable, reusable masks to every resident who requests them. These cloth masks can be augmented with inserts, such as a coffee filter. Funny, but only last fall, this same government tried to ban facial coverings that hid identities at massive pro-democracy street protests. Now that Beijing is again pushing for greater control of Hong Kong, the protests are back, and the masks are all the more vital as social distancing recedes. The city's contribution to the pro-mask argument now includes a study from the University of Hong Kong Laboratory, where researchers studied virus transmission in 2 groups of hamsters, some infected and some not. Researchers found that cages with mask partitions could reduce the rate of infection by 50 percentage points, to which I suspect many Hong Kongers would react with the Cantonese version of duh. In Hong Kong, wearing a mask in a pandemic is as political as using an umbrella in the rain. As I grew accustomed to the practice, I found myself puzzling over news reports from home. I noticed how questions were often framed in terms of the individual. Will a mask really protect me? What about my liberties? To many Americans, the mask is a challenge to the ethos of rugged individualism. A jutting chin is macho. Put a mask on it and you're a wuss. Conversely, the act of wearing a mask may be dismissed as liberal virtue signaling. Asia's mentality, rooted in part in the communitarian Confucian traditions, is more about we than me. Here, our masks are tools that work together to help us stay healthy. Just seeing the mask is a reminder of the risk we share and might inspire another squirt of sanitizer. Make China pay for it. Perversely, Trump's disdain for the mask has made the pandemic a battleground of tribal politics. He long ago missed his chance to unite Americans against the virus. He could have enlisted his red-capped loyalists with the masses who have heeded the warnings of public health experts. Instead of insisting that the virus would magically disappear or that concern was a so-called hoax designed to damage him politically, the commander-in-chief could have ordered the mass production of masks as a wall against the so-called invisible enemy. And he could have claimed that he'd make China pay for it. But here we still are, with the president still shunning the mask and Americans still jutting their chins, some covered, some not, and still arguing about masks as the carnage keeps mounting. Again, this was a column by Scott Duke Harris, a former reporter for the Los Angeles Times and the San Jose Mercury News, who now lives in Hong Kong. In another opinion column of USA Today, Matt Bennett and Josh Fried write, Trump, like Herbert Hoover, is, quote, the man who doesn't care, end quote. Biden can make that stick. At a recent White House event, a small business owners poured out their anguish about the economic devastation of the coronavirus shutdown. President Donald Trump made his boredom plain. He scrolled through his phone and posted on Twitter about an unrelated controversy. Yet this was just a particularly obvious display of Trump's lack of concern for the travails of his constituents. The president has shown an almost no compassion for or interest in the over 125,000 Americans who have died from COVID-19 or the 21 million newly unemployed. And he all but ignored the pain and anger of millions protesting in nearly every American city against systemic racism and police violence. This extreme lack of empathy, combined with his fumbling and erratic response to a cascading series of crises, has made it easy for Joe Biden to tag Trump with the label that Franklin Roosevelt, running in a similar moment of economic disaster, so deftly applied to Herbert Hoover, quote, the man who doesn't care, end quote. Hoover's aloofness. In the 1932 race, President Hoover should have been a much tougher target for this attack. After all, Hoover had risen to fame on his nearly miraculous works of charitable logistics. Hoover helped America feed Belgium and northern France during the German occupation of World War I, saving 9 million people from starvation. Throughout the U.S. involvement in the war, he led the efforts to keep food flowing to those desperately in need. By 1922, Hoover, a strong anti-Bolshevik, nevertheless was helping to feed 18 million Russians. Later, Maxim Gorky wrote to Hoover, quote, in all the history of human suffering, I know of no accomplishment which in terms of magnitude and generosity can be compared to the relief that you have actually accomplished, end quote. Yet despite Hoover's incredible philanthropic record, Roosevelt's campaign was able to paint the president as heartless, aloof from the misery all around him, and unequal to the task of rescuing the nation from the Great Depression. Hoover himself opened the door to this charge. He acted callously, sending the army to violently disperse Great War veterans camping out in Washington and demanding their bonus payments. He was paranoid, railing about conspiracy theories and pushing the Senate to investigate Wall Street firms for intentionally driving down the stock market in an effort to hurt him politically. And he was willfully blind, refusing to believe his own experts about the scale of the economic devastation. As historian William Luckenberg has noted, by the summer of 1932, this was all coming to a head. Acting erratically and offering policies that were woefully insufficient, quote, the country was convinced that Hoover was a cold-hearted man indifferent to suffering, end quote. Trump's similarity to Hoover. In the summer of 2020, that should sound hauntingly familiar. Our current president is callous, using force to remove peaceful protesters outside the White House to clear the way for a bizarre photo op outside a church. He is paranoid, spewing nonsense about plots hatched against him by former President Obama, Twitter, and apparently anyone who mails in their election ballot. And he is out of touch with reality, insisting, against all evidence, that his administration had, quote, met the moment and prevailed, end quote, that the COVID-19 death rates are inflated, that miracle cures exist, and that a vaccine is around the corner. Most of all, Trump is the man who doesn't care. He doesn't feel your pain. He doesn't mourn the dead, comfort the grieving, or support the struggling. He doesn't consider his words or worry that they could have consequences. He doesn't listen to experts or ponder his options. He takes, quote, no responsibility at all, end quote. The COVID crisis has ensured that this election, like its 1932 predecessor, will be a referendum on the president. Rather than making a choice between two competing visions, voters in 2020 mostly will decide whether they want more of what they've been getting from Donald Trump. There are two sides to that coin. Voters will make an intellectual decision, weighing actions and policy. Did Trump move against the virus quickly enough? Was his response big enough? Has he handled the police, violence, protests appropriately? But they also will make an emotional decision. They know that whoever they choose will impact their psyches for 4 years. In making that choice, voters should be reminded to weigh whether they believe that Trump has any real investment in them. Does he understand their lives, their struggles, and their fears? Does he think deeply and care passionately about people like them? In a recent speech, amplified in an ad, Joe Biden noted, quote, "That's what the presidency is, the duty to care for all of us, not just those who vote for us, not just our donors, but for all of us," end quote. In 1932, FDR was able to convince voters that Herbert Hoover, a famed humanitarian, simply didn't care about the ravages of the Depression on ordinary Americans. Surely, in 2020, Biden can make such a charge stick to Donald Trump, a man who proves every day that he cares only about himself. Matt Bennett is Executive Vice President, and Josh Fried is Senior Vice President of Third Way. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.